This is the Education Gadfly Show.
They have to be driving results. And so it's not the old horse trade. It's a different horse trade.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guests for this week, Laura Slover and Mike Cohen. Laura and Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah, there we go. Oh, in stereo. That sounded really good. I like that. For our guests, in case you don't know, Laura is CEO of CenterPoint Education Solutions. She also led the development of the PARC assessments back in the day, which is, I guess, kind of back a while ago now. Man, the time flies when we're all having so much fun. Laura's organization, in some ways, the successor organization to that, and to Achieve. And Achieve is where Mike Cohen spent many years running that wonderful organization, Achieve, which was leading many standards-based reform efforts. And before that, Mike was everywhere. U.S. Department of Education, National Governors Association. He's been doing standards-based reform for literally decades. The two of them have contributed so much to the movement for standards and testing and accountability in education. And we are going to talk about the future of all that today on Ed Reform Update. Okay, Laura, Mike, you've got a really great article from Future Ed, from Tom Talks organization at Georgetown. It is called Unfinished Agenda, The Future of Standards-Based School Reform. And that's what you write about, and that's what we're going to talk about. We have taken notice here at Fordham, and in fact, recently, both Checkerfin and Dale Chu have written articles about it. We're going to talk about some of their concerns as we go forward. Let's start here. You do a lot about the past, about the history of standards-based reform and how it evolved and what it has achieved in the past, and then shift to talking about the future, which is what we're really going to focus on today. You talk a lot about instructional coherence and the importance, let's say, at the school level of having high-quality instructional materials combined with professional development aligned to those instructional materials, assessments that are aligned to the curriculum as well, right? And then you say, okay, if that's what we're after here, what is it that states need to do and what is it that districts need to do? So first of all, do I have that basically right about when you think about a school that has instructional coherence, that's those three elements are the big ones? Laura, is that about right?
Yes, I'd say that the core, the instructional core includes the curriculum, which is based on high quality, career-ready, college and career-ready standards, the instructional practices and the professional learning that supports those instructional practices, and then all of the assessments that measure those. And those could be diagnostic, formative, interim assessments, but the core system of assessments.
Okay. Now, I think that most people would agree with that. Where there's a question, though, is how do you get to the point where schools have that instructional coherence? I would argue, for example, we see a lot of that in the high quality charter school sector, where you've got these charter school networks like KIPP and Achievement First have been around a long time, and they take this stuff very seriously. And they've been able to build schools with a lot of instructional coherence, right? In your paper, you're talking about how to do that, though, at scale, including in the traditional public school sector. And you think there's a state role here. So, Mike, back in the old days, we used to say, okay, states, they should set the standards. They should create the assessments, align to the standards. They should have an accountability system that focuses on results. And in some cases, end of story. And now you're saying, no, that's not enough.
That's right. So that strategy, right, which has been around since the early 1990s, states set the outcome goals, measure whether they're being met, and hold schools accountable for that. That would have worked if it were the case that schools had the capacity to organize and deliver a coherent instructional program, but they didn't, right? And the evidence for that is clear because 20 years later, there's still, rampant incoherence. The tests that students take throughout the year may or may not be aligned to the standards. The curriculum may or may not be aligned to the standards. The professional development that teachers get is usually not in the delivery of a well-aligned curriculum. Everything is atomized, and that just doesn't get to the point where we need to be. One way to think about that is, are students actually doing the work they need to be doing, right, that would prepare them to meet the standards? And if they're not, then we're never going to get there. And the only way the students will be doing that work is if all those other pieces come together coherently.
Right. Look, this debate's been going on a long time. You've had this debate with Checker for a long time. I mean, I think it was in the 90s or maybe early 2000s. I think there was a summit, a national education summit that Achieve held. And you got some people to say, hey, we need to do more about capacity. And the teachers unions were on board and you had some business leaders on board. And I think that meant in part curriculum was what people meant by capacity building. I mean, more money, but more know-how, more technology, more help, more assistance, more curriculum. You know, and Schechter would say, no, you know, look, just hold the schools accountable and then let them figure it out. Otherwise, you're trying to micromanage them from on high. And that's not going to work either. So now I think you say to Schechter, all right, but your strategy didn't work. Maybe there wasn't enough accountability, because the idea was that these schools would go looking for good curriculum. They'd go looking now that they were like on the line. That didn't work. Maybe in the charter sector it did, but outside the charter sector, it did not work. So what gives you hope, Mike, that states actually can do this? You know, you'd think that if all these years ago, somebody would have tried to build capacity from the state level. And so, you know, what is it that they actually have to do? And why do you think it's going to work?
So a couple of answers to that. One is we've seen states provide leadership on this. Louisiana is Exhibit A for this. They took the lead in part by first of all evaluating the instructional materials that were available to the schools and figuring out which ones at least were aligned to the standards and which ones weren't, right? And provide incentives for districts to select the ones that were well aligned. By the way, anyone could do that now just by relying on the reviews that Ed Reports does. They don't have to rely on it, but that would simplify the task. So again, Louisiana did that and then provided professional learning opportunities in the use of those materials, not some other set of materials or not generic materials, but those. And so we've seen that as an example of how that can be done. A handful of districts around the country, largely urban districts, is what we have data on, have done things quite similar to that. They doubled down on instructional coherence, have made a very clear image of what good instruction looks like. They organized professional learning around that. They organized resources around that. They prepared leaders to lead that kind of work. In at least more than a handful of urban districts that had this kind of sustained focus, they got better results, way better results on NAEP than states have been getting with a more dissipated strategy.
All right. I mean, that all sounds great. I want to get Laura back in here again, too. I am sympathetic to a lot of this, especially at the district level, which we'll talk about. But, you know, it's kind of technocratic, pretty top down, pretty centralized. And it assumes that these states are going to be able to settle on these high quality instructional materials based on expert reviews and incorporate them. It completely ignores the fact that we've got these raging education culture wars going on right now. Right. That you've got some places out there like in Florida where they're doing reviews that are all about whether the materials are woke or not. And by the way, the governor there looks like he might be our next president, right? And other Republicans are paying attention to what he's up to. So isn't that a big problem, Laura? Like, is this the moment to try to double down on sort of top-down statewide curriculum?
Well, I want to clarify that Mike's and my paper didn't call for, we're not calling for a managed statewide curriculum. What we are proposing is that states require that districts provide guidance around curriculum, much in the way that Mike suggested, or that they create an opportunity for a single curriculum that wouldn't necessarily take autonomy away from charter schools. That's not what we're suggesting. We're saying that for a district to meet state requirements, it has to show evidence of a high quality curriculum and aligned and coherent system built around that curriculum. So that curriculum really is the lead driver behind the accountability system that follows.
Incoherence should not be an option for local districts. You don't have to use a statewide curriculum, but you shouldn't get away with using an incoherent approach.
Okay. So you would allow them to say, hey, we're going to use something, you know, these raters don't like it. You know, let's say it's the Lucy Calkin stuff that has been panned increasingly by Ed Reports, but also by the phonics people, by many of us who are not big fans of Lucy Calkin. But let's say a district said, hey, we've been using it for years. Our teachers love it. We're out in the suburbs. Our new parents like it. So we're going to keep doing it, but we're going to have coherence around it in the ways that you describe. So you would say, yeah, you can do that. Maybe what? As long as you get decent results, or we'll leave you alone.
Yeah, we're not walking away from measuring results.
That's right. It's not just, do you have the right components and wrap them in a bow and they look pretty? They have to be driving results. And so it's not the old horse trade. It's a different horse trade. of making sure there's really clear guidelines, not just about the ends, but also around what needs to be in place to reach those ends.
And I'm glad you mentioned the horse trade. I mean, you're referring there to, I think it was Lamar Alexander, maybe, way back when, saying, you know, the horse trade of accountability in return for results. And now you're saying, well, the accountability, there's going to be accountability for results, but also accountability for some of the process stuff, at least curriculum. I mean, maybe I should just back up and say, it feels like we're putting curriculum at the heart of everything, right? That we're now saying, look, at this point, at least on standards-based reform, we are doubling down on curriculum as the reform strategy. 10 years ago, say, the focus instead was on teachers and teacher effectiveness and teacher evaluation. That's where we doubled down. That didn't work out so well. Now we're doubling down on curriculum as sort of the centerpiece. What's the argument for that? Do we have evidence that that's worked places? Why is this not going to be sort of teacher evaluation 2.0?
So let me come at it from a slightly different direction to answer that question, right? Because the question I pose to you is, what's the alternative to this? So for example, the Dale Chew's paper that you referenced before is essentially basically saying, decentralize all of these decisions, right? The educators in the school ought to figure this stuff out all by themselves.
Right. You basically say to a district, turn every school into a charter school or into a charter-like school, as was the plan in, say, Indianapolis has followed the strategy to some degree. Denver, once upon a time. Yes. It's also the Paul Hill notion. It's the Near F. Kingsland relinquishment notion. Yes.
And Dale's paper demonstrates just how difficult it is to pull that strategy off in district. Okay. At the other end of the continuum, think about Morgan Polyakov, who, number one, makes a big deal out of curriculum, appropriately, I think. But he also says, look, I'm skeptical about how far we're going to get with any of these strategies, because the problem here, right, is local control. We just need to get rid of that, right? And then we can really make some progress.
He wants to be France, right?
If the choices here are further decentralization down to the school building level on the one hand, or ending local control on the other, I actually think we've picked the path that is most likely to work.
And there have been some studies on curriculum. A lot of them have not been super positive, right? I mean, Tom Kane did a big study, hoping to see big results, didn't find them. So to the skeptic that says either there's not evidence or look, this feels like things we've tried years ago was let's tinker with the inputs and let's tinker with the curriculum and let's tinker with the, what gives you hope, especially at this moment in time? And maybe I'll go to Laura, like right now at this moment, after the pandemic, after, you know, where we're at with the Common Core and the assessments and all of that, why curriculum now?
Well, actually, I think there is research that's not well known about, and I'm gonna punt it back to Mike because he's been digging through the research about districts and that what happens when districts use a coherent system, they do get results. So, Mike, back to you.
Laura's talking about research that was reported last summer from Great City Council, Great City Schools, which identified 7 or 8 districts, right? That, if you will, beat the demographic odds, right? Got much better performance, particularly on NAEP, right? This is an urban, you know, urban districts NAEP, got much better performance on that over a decade's work than we've seen nationally. I mean, the effect sizes are noticeably larger. And the strategy that each of those districts used was essentially what we're talking about, right? A district-wide effort to build and improve the capacity for better instruction. There are a bunch of other districts that Great City Schools looked at, right? I think they call them the counterfactual districts, right? Which mainly are the districts that didn't show any improvement. And they had a similarly incoherent approach, if you will, to, or at least an uneven approach to improving instruction. The other thing is, this is not an ideal time, right, to put curriculum at the center. And frankly, as we were writing these papers, it was not yet clear just how much of a culture war we would see over curriculum. So I suppose if I were a district leader right now, I'd at least proceed cautiously in this way. I'd probably not advertise, right, a large, you know, a huge curriculum focus, but I'd find the ways that incrementally I could move in this direction. On the theory that curriculum instruction is the core function of, you know, it's the core work of schools. And we always ought to be working to improve that. And I would try to find a way to not make this a culture war issue, but actually keep it at least to appear to be technocratic issue. Although, in fact, you would need to build a stronger professional culture in schools to make this work. I would just proceed cautiously and smartly on this.
I want to add one thing about another reason I think it's a tricky time is that we're seeing a large boost in the number of resignations of teachers. And anytime you're going to implement something new and implement it with care and fidelity, it takes time. And so this may seem like an inopportune time given the amount of churn and the COVID recovery. But I would argue that there's also a lot of money, a lot of federal money that is coming in to schools and districts to help support them with COVID recovery. And in a moment where there's going to be, you know, a shortage of teachers, efficiency and quality matter more. And getting people on the same page to implement something makes a lot more sense at a moment when there's fewer people. Get them all on the same page and get them moving, rowing in the right direction.
We will finish on that more optimistic note there, which I appreciate, Laura. Thank you.
I'm always the optimist. It can be done, Mike.
I love it. I love it. Well, hey, again, Laura Slover, Mike Cohen, really appreciate you coming on the show. You all should go check out their paper, Unfinished Agenda, The Future of Standards-Based School Reform at Future Ed. And hey, I hope you'll come back sometime down the road and we can talk about how this is going. I certainly am hoping that this education culture war blows over and we can get back to the meat and potatoes of actually trying to improve outcomes for kids. And look, I think curriculum reform is a hugely important part of that. And question is how to make that happen in the real world. So again, Mike and Laura, thanks so much for being on.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
So, yeah, you know, interesting stuff on standards-based reform and on curriculum reform. You know, are you as skeptical as Checker is that states can actually do curriculum-based reform, or do you agree with him that that's just going to get caught up in all the culture wars right now and just lack of capacity?
I do think it's going to get caught up in some culture wars. I think a state's going to have to know its own politics to see whether it's going to be able to fly or not. I mean, obviously, we've had some, you know, case study states that have been able to pull it off, Louisiana being our flagship state. So it gives us encouragement. It can happen other places, but boy, proceed with caution is what I'd say.
And maybe, you know, fly below the radar screen to some degree as well.
Yeah, that too.
Best you can. All right. Hey, what you got for us this week?
We have a new report from Calder looking at whether CTE concentration in high school, and this time that means taking four or more CTE courses, because I know it used to be three, now it looks like it's four. And post-secondary outcomes, they're looking at whether those things are linked, particularly whether kids tend to major in college in their same high school CTE concentration field. They don't discuss, because I know maybe you're going to ask me later, the kids who don't attend college. That's really not their focus in the study. It takes place in Kentucky. They track four cohorts of all public high school graduates between 2013 and 2016. They're looking at students in eighth grade through college. In terms of data, they have the student's declared major, which I thought was interesting, then their actual major and type of credential earned, and then the field that it's in. They can account for observable differences among students. So they've got your standard demographics, race, FRL, that kind of stuff. They've also got end-of-course test scores. They've got ACT performance. They've got eighth grade achievement they can control for. They can look at the high school that they attended, so they can compare outcomes for students in the same high school. But still, it's not randomized. You still have to take it with a grain of salt because they can't control for student motivation or other differences that might have led kids to enroll in CTE in the first place. So there's my big caveat. On the descriptive front, concentrators scored at least a quarter of a standard deviation lower than non-concentrators on eighth grade test. They were more likely to have FRL, SPED, and limited English status. They find that, now Mike, this is kind of surprising. Quick little mini quiz. What percentage of graduates in Kentucky do you think took at least four CTE courses over those years?
Wow. Okay. Now, the national
concentration rate is about 20%, I think. That's with the three courses. So for four courses, then it's Kentucky. The rural states sometimes do more CTE. I'll go with 25%.
61%.
What?
Yeah, no, I don't know if they passed some kind of, I don't know. I didn't have time to look into the Kentucky policy to see, you know, how their graduation requirements may have changed. Anyway, 61% took at least four CT courses. Among those, 27% focused in the occupational field. I'm like, what is that? Okay, that includes criminal justice administration, teacher's aides, social work, child care, and firefighting. That's occupational. 21% focused on applied STEM, so that's computer science, data processing, industrial mechanics, and automotive mechanics. 17% in business, and 5% in health. Those should be, you know, easy to figure out. The largest share, 29-30% of CTE concentrators did not focus on any single field, meaning their four courses or more were scattered among different, you know, fields. Students who concentrate in health and business scored higher on eighth grade tests than concentrators in the other fields, and those in those occupational fields tended to be the most disadvantaged, lower scoring. We've heard this before. Concentrators were more likely to enroll in two-year colleges versus four-year universities, although once again, these health and business concentrators enrolled in four-year colleges more often, and 20% of those earned an associate's degree or higher, compared to the 30% of concentrators in all these other fields. So they tended to go a little farther with the health and business folks. As for majors, so then they look at, okay, did they major in these things? One-third of health concentrators declared a health major. So, you know, when you enter college, you kind of declare a major and, you know, you can change it, obviously. But the most frequently declared major was liberal arts, regardless of the field of high school concentration. Still, when they came down to looking at actual credentials and not just declaring your major, the majority of CTE concentrators did not obtain a post-secondary credential in a field that they focused on. I think that was the headline finding. Even in health, where most of the, you know, a lot of kids said, okay, I'm going to do this health thing, just 15% of the concentrators actually ended up obtaining a health-related credential. Getting to the end here, even though CTE concentrators were somewhat less likely than non-concentrators to enroll in college overall, if they did enroll, they were more likely to obtain a post-secondary credential, again, especially in business and health. They looked at gender, race, very few differences there. And so this will set us up for a nice conversation, Mike. They had a little discussion about, you know, what's the purpose of CTE courses in high school? Are they for exploration? Should they be for more substantive pursuits? Then the fact that the health field was most clearly defined, it got you thinking, okay, well, should we be trying to better sequence or make stackable these credentials in other fields since we don't seem to have that quite down? So that's what I got for you this week.
All right. Very good. Well, it seems like, look, again, more good news as I read it from CTE. You know, no evidence that we're back in the bad old days of career tech or in those days, VoTech. You know, being a lower track, you know, for the kids who could not do well academically, right? It seems like
Right. Outcomes
are pretty darn good for kids who do this. Is it because of the coursework? Is it because these kids have some sense of direction or motivation? Maybe hard to know, but certainly encouraging and better to concentrate than just to take a scattering of courses, probably, right?
Yeah, but what do you make of the majority of the concentrators not getting a credential in the field?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, is that so surprising? I mean, they're choosing these concentrations when they're what, 16, you know, and we probably could do a better job in providing guidance to kids about what they might like. I've written about this recently at Education Next about some of these new generation computer-based assessments that really try to get at kids' aptitudes rather than just their interests, you know, really try to do these brain games to understand what they're actually good at and steer them in the direction of maybe some areas they hadn't considered before. So maybe we do more of that, you know, we'll get better results. But look, we are talking about young people who are still exploring and are, you know, still trying to figure out what it means to find a career. You know, it does seem like at the high school level, at the college level, at almost every level, when you choose business, you choose healthcare, these are pretty good bets, right?
They are. We keep hearing that in various studies.
So that's, and you know, healthcare, look, it's not, oftentimes we talk about healthcare being a system that's just as messed up as education is, but they seem to be doing some things right, at least on the workforce side. You know, they've got mm-hmm. some very clear pathways for people, you know, come in at maybe one of these lower level nursing mm-hmm. assistant types, but a pathway to get more education and experience to be able to get better certifications and better titles that get you more money over time.
Yeah, better pay. Yeah. I mean, it's actually a field with a career ladder. You know, we always complain we don't have that in teaching, got a master teacher, and then you got to be a principal, but a lot of teachers don't want to do that. So we've been trying for so long to get a career ladder going, but yeah, health field definitely has one of those.
Yeah. Or even just at the beginning, right? We talk about, you know, grow your own programs to get teaching assistants to become mm-hmm. full-time teachers. And I think that's happening more maybe than in the past. Still, my sense is that's still quite rare, you know. So what can we learn from that? Well, good. Well, you know, a little birdie tells me that we may have our own news on the CTE front coming soon. So I bet we'll return to these discussions.
Yes, we will. We're going to be looking at industry recognized credentials next month and have some good information to share with our listeners about that.
All right. Very good. Well, hey, thank you, Amber. That is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm Amber Northern.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.